with my stick or sadati chat, I feel like one of the old Onondaga speakers, but I won't try to speak on the Onondaga, which I don't really know. On this occasion, I should remind those of you who are new to this audience that this conference originated at a place called Red House in southwestern New York, near the Allegheny Reservation and the Allegheny State Park. In later years, we moved the fire to various sites until it finally came to rest here in Rensselaerville. Rensselaerville is what Brooks Atkinson, the drama critic of the New York, is it the Herald Tribune or the Times, dubbed the Athens of Albany County. On this occasion, we can't just open the meeting and uncover the fire. There are empty places where several of us used to sit. And it would be only proper, I think, to condole their loss, not with a full form of condolence, which has 15 messages and would take more than an hour if I were capable of doing it, but with a shorter form, which contains the three bare words of requickening, to wipe away the tears, to open the ears so you can hear my message, and to clear your throats so that you can speak. The other element was called to cover the graves. I mention this because various colonials in the course of the 17th and 18th century heard these recitations that preceded general meetings and treaties. And they began to wonder how much of it was really necessary and was there a short form. And an inquiry was directed to George Crogan, or Crohan, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, who was the deputy to Sir William Johnson in Pennsylvania. And he got a hold of Scaronia Day, an old Oneida, who was very learned in these matters. And Scaronia Day said that it was essential that the three bare words of the tears, the ears, and the throat, he said, and the fourth, to cover the graves. So that became the short form, and that is the form that I use here at the Wood's Edge to open the way for tributes to several of us who have gone the long trail.
As you can see from the program, there are six people that we've lost in the last year that we thought that it would be appropriate to make special mention of tonight. The first is Anne-Marie Shimoni. Her husband, Abner Shimoni, is with us this evening, and he brought along some memorabilia that were over in the weather vane earlier this evening, and I think maybe they've been moved down here now, but you may have had a chance to look at those. If you don't, I hope you do later. And Floyd Lounsbury is going to say a few words about Anne-Marie.
Thank you. It is with much sadness that one must do this. Anna Marie Anrod Shimoni died of cancer at her home in Wellesley on November 26, 1995. She was 67 years old. She was born in Frankfurt am Main in Germany in 1928. Her family left Germany because of the developments there in 1938. Her father was a judge in the Supreme Labor Court of West Rhine-Palatinate, but he was dismissed from his position there because of his ancestry. He was a veteran of the First World War. He wore the Iron Cross, and that gave him enough influence so that he could get his family. Out of Germany. They first went to England, and in 1940 came to the United States. He taught first at Loyola University and I think maybe at Northwestern University, and Anna Marie graduated from Northwestern University. She had an interest in anthropology due to her studies with Melville Herskovitz, and she enjoyed museum work. She worked in the Field Museum in Chicago, and this influenced her to go into anthropology in graduate school, and she came to graduate school at Yale. At Yale, her first interest for a possible piece of doctoral research, she was interested in the Saramaka of British Guiana, but Professor Wendell Bennett, who was chairman and director of graduate studies at the time, was aware of many kinds of danger and risks, and he felt it was too great a risk, and he suggested that she might be interested in studying the Iroquois, and he directed her in my direction. And I had the great pleasure and privilege of working with her. She was a wonderful student. And she she did her dissertation and wrote her she wrote her thesis on conservatism. Let me get the title exactly right here. Well, you all know the book, Conservatism of the Iroquois at Six Nations Reserve, Ontario. At first, she taught briefly at Mount Holyoke, and then in 1961 went to Wellesley College, where she taught anthropology for 35 years. She was instrumental in establishing an independent department of anthropology at Wellesley and was the guiding force in creating an interdepartmental peace studies program at that college. She was a revered and charismatic teacher. She inspired many students to pursue professional careers in anthropology, and she taught many students the significance of anthropology for everyday social and political affairs. In May of 1995, a symposium was held in her honor entitled Native Americans, Social Justice, and the Practice of Anthropology. Her research and publications on Iroquois and on the Iroquois spanned a period of more than 40 years, and she documented major changes in Iroquois society. Every year, she went back and documented the events and chronicled them, and her great regret was that she would not be able to write up her own notes. But I'm sure that eventually they will be an important resource. She was adopted as a member of the Cayuga Nation. And in 1994, her book, Conservatism Among the Iroquois at Six Nations Reserve, was republished with a new introduction, reviewing recent developments among the Iroquois and the assessing the continued vitality of their traditional culture despite massive acculturation. This book was described in a review in the American Anthropologist as a classic study and the most comprehensive ethnography of any conservative Iroquoian community on either side of the border. She was a regular participant in these annual Iroquois conferences here. She also was one who felt that an anthropologist should know more than one area. And in 1960, she did work in Nigeria. And this, at the time of the Biafran conflict, she was very active in the Biafra relief efforts. And she testified before the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations in respect to that. She was also active in the anti-nuclear weapons movement during the 1970s and in the 1980s, and helped establish a peace studies program at Wellesley. And she served as its director for most of the following decade. She is one who did what all of us who do work in Iroquois, with Iroquois groups should do, or with which all ethnographers ought to do, but are often negligent. She kept contact with them always. They became her friends, and she never lost contact with them. Too many of us work with a group, and then we get so involved with our work that we fail to keep in touch with them, and it gives the appearance of our being interested in them only for our own purposes, and when they have served that purpose, we're no longer interested. Not Anna Marie. She kept in touch with all of them, writing letters. And one of her friends as Six Nations, wrote a letter addressed to Anna Marie, sent it to Abner, Anna Marie's husband, with the request that he read it at Anna Marie's graveside. I'm going to have to ask somebody else to read it.
My dearest beloved friend, Anna Marie, I needed to have this done as I feel I'm in denial at the moment. Saying farewell to my very best friend, I want you to know the impact you have had on my life. My vision of a tall, beautiful, young, courageous white gal that came riding up the lane on a bike. You were brave, Anna Marie, even then, going to unknown territory, but you soon found out how safe and welcome you were. We always look forward to your visits. Your work has left a great legacy for my people, our people. For the young are stumbling about at their attempt to follow in our ancestors' footsteps. They will have a valuable resource in the books you have authored. The young hunger for knowledge you have given of yourself most of your lifetime. Now the torch has been relayed to another pair of caring hands. Someone will follow in your footprints. The dream that I shared with you has given one answers far beyond the mere humor of it. You taught young college students. I am sharing study of my native language. So on behalf of my family and my nation, we say, Nyawe, thanks for being a true friend of the rarest kind. I shall see your beauty in the sunset. Your voice will be heard when the birds sing. Your smile seen in each sunrise that will follow. One, love, Germaine. We also this year lost Bill Ritchie and Bill Fenton, who was his boss for many years. We'll say something about Bill.
Of all the anthropologists I've known with a real scientific bent, Bill Ritchie stands quite tall. Bill Ritchie grew up in Rochester just after the turn of the century. His father was a Scottish merchant tailor. He came to Rochester, where he developed a considerable industry in men's clothing. When you think of Hickey, Freeman, Adler's, McFarland's, and others. Bill went to high school, rode his bike to nearby trout streams, learned about birds, another natural phenomena. Bill was not satisfied with the education of the public schools. He wanted to attend the university. By this time, he was employed as an archaeologist at the Rochester Museum of Arts and Sciences, now the Rochester Museum and Science Center, under the guidance of Arthur Parker, who had been the state archaeologist of New York and had gone to Rochester to start a museum and a museum movement that was quite unique at the time. Parker's early archaeology segregated prehistoric people as Algonquian speakers who were succeeded by Iroquoians. And Bill grew up in this, with this point of view. He concentrated on the prehistoric peoples, the Lamota, whoever they were, and related archaic cultures. In 1933, I set out to make my first field trip to the Senecas of Western New York. There were two people in Rochester, or three people in Rochester that I really wanted to see. One was Arthur Parker, who had known my father, and who I was sure would give me advice on what to do, what needed doing. The second was Bill Ritchie, who spent endless hours with me explaining the sequence of cultures he had begun to see. The third was Robert Keane, a classmate from Dartmouth College, who was an amateur photographer and had gone to work at Eastman's and became subsequently one of the great commercial photographers. Bob Keane let me have a camera, taught me how to use it, how to keep the records, and so forth. I didn't see much of Bill Ritchie for a number of years. In the 30s, when I was at Tonawanda as a community worker, occasionally I would go to Rochester, and always Bill was there. Later on, after I joined the Bureau of Ethnology at the Smithsonian, I think it was in the summer of 1940, Charles Congdon, an attorney of Salamanca with historical interests, his son Dick, and I decided to visit Ritchie's dig on Frontenac Island and near the outlet of Cayuga Lake. Bill had uncovered an eagle burial. I'd written a dissertation on the Seneca eagle dance. I was naturally interested. I remember long conversations on the evenings after swimming the wonderful waters of Cayuga Lake. And Bill expressed to me, he says, you know, I wish I had a PhD. He says, how am I going to do it? He says, I've got a dissertation all written. And I said, well, look, I said, Duncan Strong is at Columbia. They have fellowships. They have to give them to somebody. You should apply. Well, he did. So he arrived at Columbia, as Gordon Willie just told me, with a magnum opus all in hand, and he took the courses. Now, Bill had qualified part-time at the University of Rochester. He came under the influence of George Washington Corner, one of the great medical scholars and an anatomist, and Bill learned anatomy thoroughly. He also did some preliminary work in physical anthropology. So he was probably the best grounded archaeological student at Columbia at his time. Well, he submitted his dissertation. It took the Morrissey Prize at the New York Academy of Sciences. That tells you something about him. Some years went by, and I came to Albany as director of the State Museum. Bill was already there as a state archaeologist. He'd been taken over by Carl Gouda. But his main problem was that he couldn't get any support for his research through the education department, of which the State Museum was a part. Well, having been at the National Research Council for 2.5 years, at a time when the Office of Naval Research was being transformed into the National Science Foundation, I had an idea that maybe Bill's needs could be met by a grant from the NSF. So we undertook to write a petition. Actually, he wrote it. And this was to do settlement pattern archaeology. And it all sounded very good. And the grant came through. Well, the whole Department of Education was in a real tizzy as to how to handle it. Well, we concocted a Regents Research Fund, and the Regents weren't sophisticated enough to ask for overhead on the grant, so Bill had the complete proceeds. Well, he went to work. He hired Jim Wright, who's here, and the whole summer's field work was put together in a hurry, and they needed some help. And Galen Ritchie was available, and my son John was also without too much to keep him busy. And so off they went to Long Island, and that was fine, because none of the local press down on Long Island got the attention of anybody in Auburn. But when they got up in the Mohawk Valley, and here was Galen Ritchie and John Fenton leaning on shovels, all hell broke out because the Commissioner of Education called me down. He says, you know, I have a son who needs a summer job. And so forth and so on. Well, I've forgotten how it was worked out, but they were allowed to finish their project, but never again. Subsequent grant, Bill got to work on Martha's Vineyard. That was even dicier because it was outside of New York State. And presently, the Attorney General, who summered on Martha's Vineyard, began to wonder what all these cars of New York State seals on them for official use only were doing on Martha's Vineyard. And again, I had to explain to the commissioner just what was going on. And these cars were accessed or transferred to us by the state police, and they had put 80,000 or 90,000 miles, and some of them bordered on being real jumpers. But that's the way we got around, and then we justified a fleet of our own.